Hello and welcome to Civility and Solutions, a podcast brought to you by your Court Services section of the Supreme Court of Ohio. I am your host, longtime justice enthusiast, Kate Munger. This is a podcast about inspirational ideas for courts from across our 88 beautiful Ohio counties. Today's topic relates to overcoming impasse. We'll talk about barriers to reaching a resolution and some techniques mediators can use to get parties to settlement. The views expressed by guests to this podcast don't necessarily express the views of the Supreme Court. We are happy to be able to use this platform to share solutions and challenges with courts and any listeners who want to stay on the cutting edge of dispute resolution and court services issues. Welcome to Season 1, Episode 15. Our topic is Overcoming Impasse by Effectively Using the Mediator's Proposal and Bracketing. Joining me today are three people who combined have over 100 years of legal experience, the Honorable Peggy Foley Jones, Douglas Godshall Esquire, and Matt Menace Esquire. Thank you all so much for being here today.
You're welcome.
Good morning.
Good morning. Peggy Foley Jones is a distinguished mediator and arbitrator and recently opened her own standalone dispute resolution practice after many years of associating with a law firm. Congratulations, Peggy. How's it going at Foley Jones Dispute Resolution?
It's going great. I'm very happy. I'm very busy. And so I got no complaints. I wish I made the decision a long time ago, but I made it.
What kind of cases does your firm handle?
I do employment mediations and arbitrations, commercial, construction, class actions, personal injury, nursing home, medical malpractice. So sort of an array of cases. I was a judge for a long time, so I had a civil docket that was quite large. So that really gave me a lot of experience.
Yes, you were a former Cuyahoga County Court of Common Pleas judge and a former 8th District Court of Appeals judge?
I was.
Do you think that judicial experience informs your perspective on mediation and arbitration?
I think it is a natural transition into dispute resolution because you're used to settling a lot of cases and you're used to working with lawyers, which is primarily the feed of my business is from lawyers. So I think it's been amazingly beneficial to start this practice and it developed my reputation in the community from being a judge for so long.
Absolutely. And in addition to many other teaching and training commitments, Peggy is also a member of the Supreme Court of Ohio's Commission on Dispute Resolution. So thank you for your service on that commission. And thank you for being here today.
Thank you for having us.
Absolutely. Next, I would like to welcome Douglas Godshall to the podcast. Doug also serves on the Supreme Court's Commission for Dispute Resolution, and Doug is a mediator and arbitrator practicing as a neutral at the probate courts of Summit and Stark counties in Ohio and in the general division of the Stark County Court of Common Pleas as a mediator in probate and civil cases. Doug, you have an extensive background as a litigator and have hundreds of jury trials under your belt. What drew you to mediation?
When the mediation process started in Ohio, a couple of lawyers and judges asked me to consider it. And I mostly had a defense practice and personal injury. So I've been doing a lot of those cases as a mediator. Probate practice was brand new to me, but I've been doing that for a while. With the help of some judges, and I have a general mediation practice where I do lawsuits of any civil kind, and work with several people, including Peggy and Matt, in working with to promote our profession and to make some presentations both statewide at the Ohio Dispute Resolution Conferences and nationally at the ABA Dispute Resolution Conference. It's been a pleasure working with Peggy and Matt. And also someone you know very well, Kathy Geyer. Thank you.
I do know her. Yes, I do. And in addition to your court work, as you said, you work at a firm and the firm's called Attorneys Mediation Services, LLC in Canton, Ohio. Do you want to give a plug to your business and the mediators who work there?
Well, it's the oldest mediation practice in Stark County, and it's the most successful one in Northeast Ohio for many years, led by Jeff Wilcup and Joe Calabretta. I'm pleased that they asked me to join them a few years ago, and it's a very interesting and we think very successful private mediation practice.
Great, thank you. And next, I would like to introduce our third guest today. Matt Menes is a mediation attorney for the 9th District Court of Appeals. And before that, he was a mediator for the Common Pleas Courts in Lake and Cuyahoga County. Over the past 10 years, Matt has helped resolve more than 1,000 civil cases in his capacity as court mediator. Matt, are there differences in mediating appellate cases and cases at the Common Pleas level? Did anything surprise you in appellate mediation?
Sure. Well, hi, Kate. And yeah, it's a very good question. And it's a question I get a lot. Actually, even stepping back a bit, people ask, why would you mediate a case on appeal? Somebody has already been declared a winner or loser at the trial level. And so that's the biggest difference, is that, you know, the cases that are on appeal have more history behind them. There may be an adjudicated decision. Sometimes it might be, you know, a ruling on a motion or something like that, but other times they've gone all the way through a jury trial. And so the case has more baggage, I guess, and more things to unpack. But the core principles are the same. The parties are still tangled in this litigation. They're still not able to move on with their lives. And so my role as mediator is very similar. I'm still trying to help them look at alternatives, help them weigh their options, and negotiate a resolution that hopefully brings some finality to their dispute. But yeah, it's more challenging on appeal oftentimes than it was at the trial level.
And you once held a job that I think sounds really interesting. You were the director of arbitration for the New York Stock Exchange in its San Francisco office. What was that like?
It was very interesting. We had our, you know, we had our own rules. We were governed by the SEC and some other governmental agencies, but we had our own forum rules. I managed a large pool of arbitrators and mediators. And actually managing that caseload and working with our arbitrators and mediators is when I first got the mediation bug myself, and was fascinated by these cases that I would send out to mediators, and I never came back because they were settled, which of course was great for our forum and great for the parties, but I was curious about why that was happening. And so I took my first mediation training in San Francisco, worked as a mediator out there for a little bit before moving back to Ohio. And when I came here, came back to Ohio, that is, decided to make dispute resolution my full-time job.
We're happy you did. Matt was just recently faculty of what has to be the best attended mediation training ever held in Ohio. Over 1,000 people took the eviction mediation training sponsored by the Ohio State Bar Association in March. Matt, what did you think of that training?
Well, I'm grateful that it was virtual, because I it would have been more intimidating to see that many people sitting in a classroom or auditorium. A number was just a number on the computer screen and easier to forget. But I think it surprised a lot of us that many people signed up. It was a two-part training. They're focused on mediating cases for eviction in landlord-tenant cases, and then also foreclosures on residential mortgage cases. And I think the huge attendance says two things to me. One is that, you know, our state is facing serious issues around evictions and foreclosures, and that also there's a huge interest in alternative dispute resolution and mediation. And so I'm hopeful that the folks that we trained will be able to help not only with the evictions and foreclosure cases, but also help spread the word about the benefits of mediation throughout the state.
And I hope our topic today helps some of those new mediators get off on the right foot. Are you all ready to talk about overcoming impasse today?
Sure.
Steven, let's rock and roll, Kate.
All right, let's rock. Let's do this. All right, Matt, can you start us off with the basics? What is meant by impasse in mediation?
Sure. So impasse is something that mediators hear all the time. You know, in fact, probably every case we mediate starts at a place of impasse because the parties have not been able to settle it for themselves. So what we talked about, the three of us, is defining impasse fairly broadly, which is just any time the party's negotiations hit a standstill. It doesn't mean that it's a permanent impasse, and that's really the takeaway for us. You know, we'll oftentimes have parties or their counsel say to us, you know, we're too far apart, or their demand or their offer is unreasonable, and therefore we're at impasse. And our job as the mediator, I think, is to help redefine that as, okay, impasse might mean you're at a temporary standstill in your negotiations, but I'm not sure that it means that you're at a permanent impasse where the parties are not going to be able to get through it. So for us, impasse is just anytime their negotiations hit a bump in the road, and that's where us as mediators can come in and help.
Okay. And Peggy, you wrote a fascinating article based on data you collected from your own cases. And the article was called Overcoming Anchoring, a Mediator's Empirically Based Approach to Helping the Parties Make the Right Offer and Demand. What do you mean by anchoring?
So from anchoring is a technique in mediation where people sort of focus on an issue. It's sort of like throwing your anchor into Lake Erie and it sinks to the bottom. They just kind of sit there. And it can be like an issue in the case that they're focused on, an emotional issue or something that happened to them. Or it also, the reason of my article is that they anchor, they get fixated on the numbers. You spend about an hour, 2 hours talking about the case, and then you start exchanging numbers. And when the plaintiff makes their number, they usually are high and the defendants are usually low. And so people, they sort of get anchored in on their positions. And I started to realize we're spending so much time trying to get to a reasonable settlement number, which is what our goal is. It's to settle the case, but at a reasonable number. And you hear all the time plaintiff's lawyers saying, oh, the defendant's not acting in good faith and they're lowballing us. And defense counsel saying, oh, the plaintiffs are in la-la land. They're excessive. So we spend all this time, we're anchored in just talking about what's reasonable and how the other side's unreasonable. And I started to think, how do we use that time better? Mm-hmm. So I am a big proponent of brackets. A lot of people are not, although they're getting a lot more popular. And so I sort of started to look at my cases and tried to see what is the correlation between the opening demand and the settlement and the opening offer in the settlement. And so I looked at a bunch of my civil cases and that's where I came to this article.
And so in the article, as you say, you tracked the initial offers, the demands and the settlement numbers on real cases that you mediated. And then you compare those initial demands and the offers with the numbers the cases actually ended up settling for. So that is such an interesting study.
Interesting for me is I learned three things that were very important. Number one, 85% of the cases settled. That is a high statistic. So that is great. Mediation works, right? Second of all, I learned that very surprising that pre-suit cases settled more often than filed suits. That was a shocker for me. Because normally pre-suit cases, people haven't done a lot of discovery. And so, you know, you're a little bit nervous because people don't have a lot of information. Mm-hmm. The other thing that's important to this discussion is what I've discovered from my empirical study of my 300 cases, was that plaintiff's initial demand is closer to the settlement offer than the defendant's initial offer.
Interesting.
And so I found that that was interesting. And so mediators can use that information. It gives you hope. It gives you some structure. It helps them set some thresholds for you during the course of the day when you know that, you know, most likely cases are going to get settled. And they're probably going to get closer to settle to the plaintiff's original number than the defendant's number. And so that kind of, I think, is helpful information.
I think so, too. So most mediators listening to this podcast have probably been stuck in a mediation where parties are anchoring or are at an impasse, temporary impasse. I know that these people would really appreciate some practical techniques that are going to help where they are confronted with either of those situations. So let's talk about some of those techniques. Doug, can we talk about bracketing? Have you used bracketing before? Can you tell us how it works?
Sure. It's a technique of many techniques. When the parties say they can't get it resolved, there's too much of a gulf between them, And I would add to what Peggy said, the most important thing you need when you reach an impasse is patience and the certain knowledge that most cases get settled. So keep going, find a technique that seems to work. I got a call this morning at 6 a.m. from a lawyer in another town where I mediated a case 7 months ago, and they want to know what the final numbers were because they're going to try to settle the case again. So you never know what's going to go on. Bracketing is a technique where you ask the plaintiff to put in a number that they would take and then put in a number then that the defendant would take, where you can do it the reverse. So you're asking the parties to put a number out for the other side and themselves. Sometimes you'll get a bracket like if the plaintiff will say, okay, I'll take 75, Mr. Defendant, if you pay 25, when they're stuck at 10,000 and can't move. And what that does is tell the defendant somewhere of the range of where the case can settle. Some lawyers like it, some don't. You want to inquire of the lawyers if they want to do it. Some lawyers bring it up themselves. And then we also have the issue of the client understanding. The insurance representative and the defendant's lawyer in a personal injury case are going to understand bracketing. The plaintiff may not. So you may have to spend some quiet time with the plaintiff exploring where their range might be and telling them this is an opportunity to get a range out there that's more like what the plaintiff wants as opposed to the defendant wants. So you get the clients and the lawyers involved in putting together a bracket, and you offer it out, and the bracket is either rejected or accepted. Now, as Peggy and Matt will say, on the first time, it's never accepted. It's rejected, and the other side gives another number. So if the plaintiff gave a 75-25, the defendant might come back with 60-30. And that raising what it says to the plaintiff is, okay, they're going to pay $30,000, but they really want to get in the range of between 60-30. And the plaintiff may challenge that bracket by rejecting it, giving another one. Or, as often happens, after the exchange of two or three brackets, we tumble back into traditional negotiations. When the parties figure out where the other side wants to be in the middle, the plaintiff may say, look, okay, I don't have all day for this case. I need $45,000. And the defendant comes back and says, I'm not paying any more than 40. So you're back in traditional negotiations after getting a bracket, which indicates to both sides where they want to be. But you have to be very careful with both the lawyers and the clients when you start out. Some lawyers do not like them. Other lawyers love them. And the clients sometimes don't understand it. So you're going to have to back off, sort of refresh, and explain to them what bracketing is and what the advantages are.
Now, do you always start those bracketing discussions in a caucus?
Typically not. Typically, the joint caucus, it would start with a separate caucus with the plaintiff's group and the defendant's group, either parties. Typically, we don't start off in the joint caucus with any kind of a bracket. Bracket is sort of a fallback because we're at impasse. The parties say we can't get together. The plaintiff wants 90,000, the defendant wants 10. So you ask them to compromise and put together a bracket. After the first bracket is constructed, you go to the other side and tell them you can reject it or accept it or go back to traditional negotiation. And sometimes the parties have questions of me. Where do you think they are? What do you think they want to do? And we do a lot of guessing in mediation, but we don't guess where they're going to end. We're going to guess where they're not going to end. You tell them, look, I know the defendant's not going to pay 90. I know the plaintiff's not going to take 10, but we're not going to be telling them what they're going to take. It's a further consequence of my fervent belief that mediators need to stop evaluating cases as I evaluated them as a trial lawyer and listen to the lawyers and see what the essence of the negotiations are. It's their case. We want them to settle them with our assistance.
Okay, very good. And Matt or Peggy, do you have any other tips for using bracketing or anything that's worked for you with that technique?
Sure. So I would echo what Doug said, and bracketing is usually a tool that the mediator uses when the parties have declared that they're in impasse or they're frustrated that the other side is too high or too low. The other time that bracketing can be used is if the parties are frustrated at the progress or the speed at which the negotiations are taking place. If they're $100,000 apart and on each move, each side is moving $5,000 or $10,000, and they're thinking, gosh, this is going to take several hours longer than it needs to. Sometimes a bracket is a way to jumpstart the negotiations and narrow the range and sort of fast forward ahead to a point where the parties are negotiating inside of a range that they each agree is a reasonable settlement range, and they just need to figure out where in that range the settlement might land. But you know, the mediator's value that they bring to the table, like Doug said, is patience and persistence, but it's also perspective, and it's a way that they can help the parties look at their negotiations and look at their case differently. And raising this idea of bracketing is a way to reframe the negotiation and get them to think about the dispute differently. It might open up some options for settlement. Peggy?
I like to use brackets when we're in different ranges. So for example, if one side's in the six-figure range and hundreds of thousands, and the other side's under 50,000, I've got to get them in the same range if I'm going to get this case settled. So one way of doing that is to suggest to one of the parties, how about suggesting we change the strategy we're using? So instead of you giving me this number, would you be willing to suggest a bracket? Now, when they suggest the bracket, what happens is I'll take it, one side presents the bracket. Then you go to the other side and say, they're presenting a bracket now. We're changing the strategy. How do you want to respond? They will most of the time respond with a counter bracket. And everybody can kind of see what happens is lawyers, Kate, will go to the middle number. So if I propose 100 and 200, that means, plaintiffs want to sell for 150. And then defendants present 50 and 100. Oh, they want to sell for 75. So people kind of have a sense, and it gives them hope. Oh, maybe we'll get there. They will pay more than what they offered. So it's a very hopeful opportunity is the way that I look at it. And I also will say that sometimes I will suggest a bracket. I'll say, instead of, if you don't want to do it, I have to figure out who's the best side to present the bracket. That's something the mediator has to decide who to suggest it to. To defendants maybe should present the bracket first, or should the plaintiff suggest it first? You have to think about that. And sometimes, and I have to say, you have to trust me. I do this every day. And you have to trust, and you haven't worked with me before, that I think we should go into brackets. And then they will listen to you. So I think that's important to have the confidence to do that and let them know that this has worked before.
I would add one thing, Kate. Most of the time, brackets suggest a midpoint, and it's a natural tendency that everybody's eyes go towards the middle. Mm-hmm. But there's a caution, and like Doug said, you have to be careful using brackets. I always like to the person who's proposing the bracket first and say, on its face, a bracket is just an agreement to negotiate in this range. But as a practical matter, the eyes go towards the middle. And, you know, what are your thoughts about that? Is that the sort of signal you want to send? And if they come back and say, you know, I have the bottom end of the bracket, but I don't have a penny more, then you might talk to them about, do you want to propose a different bracket? Because, you know, negotiations are just going to stall out again if they accept your bracket and then you say, I'm done. Mm-hmm. So strategizing with them about what sort of message they want to send with the bracket, because brackets, as Peggy said, and Doug both, they're not usually accepted the first bracket, but it's oftentimes countered with another bracket. And so it's an invitation to look at the negotiations differently, and you want to make sure that they understand what messages they're sending when they do send over that first bracket.
And another very attractive feature is that one side gets to tell you versus via the bracket what the other side's number ought to be. People always want to be able to tell the other side what to do. You know, if I was the other side, I would be offering X, or I would be demanding X. So you get them to have a little fun with the other side. And I try to make it light and try to laugh about what the other side's doing and so forth, but it gives them an opportunity to kind of step out of traditional negotiation instead of just saying the other side's offer demand is rotten.
Thank you all for those bracketing technique ideas. Now I want to turn to Peggy, and I want to shift gears and talk about another technique to break through impasse, and that is a mediator's proposal. Can you describe how to use a mediator's proposal?
Sure. A mediator's proposal is something that, let's say you've gone through brackets and the case hasn't settled. Now you're 5 o'clock. Now you're tired and it's the end of the day and the parties are truly at an impasse. It's not going to settle. So oftentimes lawyers will ask, will you, mediator, please give us a proposal? or I can suggest to the parties, would you consider a mediator's proposal? So a mediator's proposal is a number that the mediator will give to the parties to consider to try to resolve the case. And it's sort of an all or nothing number. It is not what the mediator evaluates the value of the case to be. It's just a push for both parties. After speaking with the parties all day, we have a sense of where they want to be. Because remember, we're the only one in the room that knows in both rooms what they're saying, right? So we have a sense of where they want to be at the end of the day. And so I do my mediator's proposal. It's called a double blind proposal. I like to do them at the mediation when everybody's there so we can end it that day. People are anxious to get the case resolved. I don't want them going home and talking to their family members or changing their minds or lose the momentum that we've gained all day. So I take out a piece of paper and I go back and I review my notes for about 15 minutes. First, I bring the lawyers into the room and I say, would your clients consider a mediator's proposal? I explain the process like this, that I will give you a number on a piece of paper and you either mark yes or no. You can't change the number. And so if both parties say yes to the number, the case settles. If one party says yes and one party says no, the case did not settle and the no party is not allowed to know what the other person said, right? So the yes person's always gonna know that it settled. So they work 95% of the time, they work. You just give them a piece of paper, they go to the room, they talk to the client and they fill it out. So it's a very valuable tool for a mediator to use. And some of the advantages are because sometimes, because we're neutral and we're impartial, sometimes it carries some weight to some of the parties if they have what the mediator mm-hmm. proposal is. It takes it out of the lawyer's hands. Now they're truly listening to the neutral. It can also sort of change our role. It looks like we're being a little more evaluative versus being facilitative, but you've already explained that to them and they've already agreed to that. They want this from the mediator. I think it's a very valuable tool. I'm using it more now than I have in a long time. And again, they're very successful. What are your, Doug or Matt, do you have any other, do you do it any differently?
Yeah. In addition to carrying your article with me in my briefcase and Frank Jay's article on preparing the client, I carry around David Schaefer's article. Dave's a very good mediator and a trial lawyer, and I know him from law school in Cleveland. And when he comes to the mediator's proposal, he says things like, you do this for a living. Of course you know what it should settle for. You should have an opinion, okay? And we want to say, yeah, we have an opinion of where we think the parties are. We're not evaluating the case. But yes, they think that we know where this thing should end. You've got to be very careful how you frame it. But I use the more and more mediator's proposals more and more because we have some sense of where they might end up based upon the negotiations after a few hours. I have a partner who lets them sit overnight or 72 hours and he writes them a note. I agree with Peggy. I want to get the signatures that night before we have any buyer's remorse.
And Doug, as someone who has been an attorney for a side before for parties, for our listeners who might be an attorney for a party, is there anything that they would need to be careful of when a mediator's proposal is put into play? Any considerations you would have?
Yes, the lawyer needs to know that I'm not evaluating the case on its merits as a jury would or as a judge might in a bench trial. I'm evaluating what I have heard from the parties and what they've said regarding their settlement positions. And now, I don't know how seriously they take that. I think that when we give a mediator's proposal, a lot of people are saying to themselves, this is what the mediator thinks the case is worth, which is okay, but I'm not going to say that, and I'm not evaluating. But there is a principle of mediation we need to take care of, which says, you know, the party settled the case, it's not the mediator.
One point I just want to make is there's no risk to this, to the parties. Because I want to follow up with the question. That was a really good question, Kate. There's no risk because if they don't accept it, it doesn't compromise the settlement position where they were. So, you know, they can go back to those numbers if they don't accept the mediator's proposal. So there's really no risk to them and the other side's not going to know. So that's why I think it's very beneficial. Sorry, Matt.
Yeah, no, I agree with that, Peggy. And I think I would go further and say it actually, you know, once you've talked to the parties about making a mediator's proposal and they've agreed that that's what they want you to do, then it incentivizes them to say yes. Because if they really want to settle the case and they want to find out if they can settle it that day, maybe your proposal is a little higher or lower than they were willing to go. But, you know, it incentivizes them to say yes, because it's a no risk proposition. If they say yes and you come back and say it didn't settle, the other side doesn't know that they said yes. All they know is that they said no and it didn't settle. So it's the anonymity and the double blind part of it is a key component to that process. I had a couple other thoughts, Kate. One is that Peggy mentioned that she does this at 5 o'clock or at the end of the day. I would encourage mediators who are going to do this later in the process or as a intervention of last resort. Sometimes counsel will ask you very early on, hey, can you make a mediator's proposal? Maybe we can wrap this up by lunchtime. And, you know, maybe there's a case where that makes sense, but most of the time, I think they're asking you too early as a shortcut. And you want to explore other options like fully negotiating or using brackets or doing other things before jumping right to a mediator's proposal. The other thought I had is that sometimes it's hard for parties to hear a proposal from the other side, or they're sick of hearing proposals from the other side. And there's actually a psychological name for this. It's called reactive devaluation. When you're in conflict with somebody, if the person you're in conflict with proposes it, you reactively devalue it. You say, oh, it's coming from that so-and-so, I'm not interested. But if it comes from a neutral third party, it doesn't carry that baggage and it might be more easily accepted. And so that's where the mediator's proposal, it's coming from a neutral, impartial third party who, as Doug said, is not telling you what they think the case is worth. They're just telling you where they think the case might reasonably settle that day. And it's oftentimes easier for one side to accept if it's coming from a neutral as opposed to from the other side. I did have one other thought now, Peggy, in terms of settling that day or not. I agree. I think especially if you spent all day in mediation, it's really important to go with that momentum and try and get the case settled with the people who have been part of the whole process, as opposed to going home and having some other person who hasn't been there all day say, yeah, that's a good deal, or no, it's a bad deal. The only exception to that is occasionally I've had cases where somebody in the mediation really wants to settle a case, but they have to go to their supervisor and get more authority, or maybe they have to go to their board and get approval because this is higher than what they talked about. If that's a case where I think, hey, my mediator's proposal is probably going to be a little out of range for them, but if I give them an extra 24 hours or 48 hours, maybe they can get that additional authority, then I'll talk to the parties about taking the proposal home and emailing me with their confidential response by a certain date or deadline. So it's like everything else in mediation. It's a flexible tool and a flexible process, and the mediator can use their discretion to maximize the party's chances of settling.
Sure. Just in the last week, I had to wait over a weekend for a final say from a corporate person. And then later on in the week, I had a very difficult case where the injured party and the family were the challenge. And after a mediator's proposal was accepted, I actually drove to the plaintiff's house, we're doing it by Zoom, to get a signature. And at the urging of parties, so we didn't have buyer's remorse and told them I wasn't charging them for it for a lot of different reasons. But whenever the iron's hot, whether it's that day or you have to wait for the next day, that's okay. And the mediator's proposal, like bracketing, can also lead to direct negotiations. If Peggy proposes a 90, and someone says, you know, I'm not going to pay 90, but I'll pay 85, that might get the case settled too. So we need to be flexible, but have patience.
I want to caution new mediators that sometimes during the course of the day, a lawyer will say, hey, will you propose this number as a mediator's proposal? They'll try to kind of, you know, get in the back door. Be careful of that, because it has to be your evaluation. You have to be strong and tell them it's not what you want it to be. So what I think would be a fair settlement value.
So I think a lot of what I'm hearing from you is you really have to probably build up your trust as a neutral, the party's trust in you as the mediator throughout the process, so that if it gets to the point of using a mediator's proposal, you've already built that respect as being a neutral, somebody that they can count on, like throughout the whole process. So I think that that's something that builds from the beginning to be able to set forth this mediator's proposal, that the parties trust you to come up with something that is in every, you know, like that's fair.
Yeah, no, I agree, Kate. Trust is everything for the mediator, and you build that relationship and that rapport with the parties. They tell you things in caucus that you keep in confidence and you don't share with the other side. You maintain yourself as a professional and as a neutral, and all that trust builds up goodwill and confidence in you, so that if you get to the point of proposing a bracket or a mediator's proposal, it's taken seriously and it's viewed as coming from, you know, a neutral, impartial, helping place as opposed to an advocate's place.
All right, now let's go to Doug, because there's a third technique that we can discuss, and that is when the mediator suggests a range. And how is that different from a mediator's proposal? And what are the benefits of the technique of mediator suggesting a range?
This is probably one of my least attractive alternatives when we're looking at impasse. Because I was a defendant's personal injury attorney, sometimes I'm asked for a range. I know a mediator in one of the courts tells the parties what the range is right away. I think that's improper. I think that's you're overstepping the mediator's role. But on small personal injury cases, I think I know what the range is that the advertising plaintiff's attorney and the in-house defense insurance company are going to say, but I don't think it's my role to do that. So I would only use this when I have a couple of lawyers that I know pretty well, that I have an idea that they're fairly experienced. I'm having some difficulty with one or the other or both. And I might suggest a range. I would probably want to go to brackets first. I would probably want to go to a mediator's proposal first rather than a range. But in certain types of cases that I'm familiar with and certain types of probate cases that I'm familiar with, I have a pretty good idea how they're going to land, either what the jury is going to do or what the range of what a jury is going to do. And that's how I would say it. Here's the range of what the jury is going to do. It's going to be somewhere between 15,000 and 50,000, which is too big of a range to be effective. Or in a probate court case with families with a will contest or fighting over a trust, I might say, well, here's the range of what the judges might do in this case. But I would probably rather use a mediator's proposal than a range, but some people want a range just to confirm to their clients, see, I told you I was right. It's worth somewhere between that and that. And that's the utility of it for the attorney who you're trying to sell. And typically in a case like that, you've got a difficult attorney that you haven't been able to sell on the benefits of resolution at that point.
Peggy or Matt, anything to add?
I would say, you know, it's kind of like a mediator's proposal. You're just, instead of giving a number, you're giving them a range. You know, every case has a zone of settlement.
Right.
What is that zone? These are rarely used a range because normally the parties want to do their own bracketing. But if they want to do it, I'm happy to do it. You know, I just kind of explained the rules of the proposal and how it's going to work. And it can be an effective tool. I agree with Doug that, you know, we could look like we're losing our neutrality. So it has to be a last resort technique, but it can work. Just get them in a zone of settlement because those brackets eventually are going to overlap.
Yeah, I would agree. I think it's if the parties have some resistance to bracketing and, you know, through your conversations and caucus with them, you're trying to figure out what's the basis for your demand because it seems so high, or what's the basis for your offer because it's so low in relation to the damages. And if I would try bracketing first, and if they're unwilling to propose a bracket and the other side is too, then maybe you could talk about, you know, well, what if I were to propose a range, you know, and it's like, it's sort of a hybrid, I guess, between mediator's proposal and bracketing, because it's the mediator suggesting a range that hopefully will then put them in the settlement zone, or what mediators call the ZOPA, the zone of possible agreement. So it puts them in the ZOPA, and then they can start to negotiate from there.
All right, so one more technique that you all have suggested as one that can help overcome impasse is BATNA. Now, most of you out there who have taken a negotiation or mediation class know that that stands for Best Alternative to a Negotiated Agreement. Matt, can you give the listeners to this podcast a crash course in BATNA and how it can be used to help an impasse situation?
Sure. Since I just said ZOPA, is that, you
ZOPA
know, I'm in the acronym world,
fun,
I guess.
Fun acronym.
Yeah, that's right. So BADNA is, as you said, best alternative to a negotiated agreement. There are actually two other related ones to BATNA. There's BATNA, then there's WATNA, which is your worst alternative to a negotiated agreement. They're totally nerdy, and they, you know, maybe it's helpful to use those terms when you're talking to parties or not. But in essence, what you're trying to get them to do is look at the alternatives. If they do not settle the case, what does that look like? What's their best alternative? What's their worst? And what's their most likely? And sometimes they're so focused on winning that they don't realize their best alternative actually comes with some baggage. They may be like, hey, I'm going to win this case and I'm all gung-ho about my BATNA. But then you start to talk to them and you're like, all right, so your BATNA is you win this judgment for a lot of money. What happens if they declare bankruptcy? Or what happens if they're not collectible? Or what happens if they appeal to the Ninth District Court of Appeals? You're still in litigation. So helping the parties understand that even their best alternative may not be as good as they think it is, or it might be more complicated than they had originally appreciated, gives you an in to talk to them about compromise and trying to reach a negotiated agreement. And part of what we do as mediators is, you know, try to get the parties to consider all the information and weigh all of their risks and exploring their alternatives. You know, if they do nothing, what happens to the case? Getting them to weigh those alternatives and weigh that risk is a way to help them make an informed decision about what they want to do in terms of settling. Obviously, the worst alternative, if you talk to them about what if you lose this motion or what if the judge or jury rules against you, they may have been thinking solely about winning. And their attorney might have only talked to them about what happens when we win. And so to have somebody else come back and say, actually, there's another way this could play out, you might actually lose, or you might lose on a motion before you even get to court, it's a bitter pill to swallow, but it's an important conversation to have. And you talked about trust earlier, Kate. I try not to lead with those sort of worst alternative scenarios until I've established some rapport and credibility with them. But once I've established that connection, then I really feel like it's my duty as the mediator to talk to them about not only the good things that could happen, but also the bad, so that they can weigh those and make an informed decision. But they're not easy conversations to have, but they're important.
And Peggy or Doug, anything to add to BATNA?
I think BATNA, you know, for me as an arbitrator, I do arbitrations with the American Arbitration Association. I do a lot of private arbitrations. So I start talking about, all right, now you're headed to arbitration. That's where you're headed. So what's your budget? You got a $50,000 arbitrator fee? You got to pay your attorney fees and you got to go through litigation. So is it possible that you'd be getting more money today than risking the risk of losing through an arbitration or a trial? So I talked to them about that. I also talked to them about this other study that's in my article about, you know, the error that plaintiffs and defendants move once they go to trial or arbitration. And the statistics of that in that article that I've talked about, it's called decision error. So what happens is that the sum of it is that plaintiffs lose more often after they've left negotiations and arbitration and mediation. They only win 61% of the time at trial. That's not that high. So I talked to them about that. What does that mean? Defendants, on the other hand, they may win more, but if they lose, they lose badly. They pay a lot more if they lose that verdict than they do at mediation. So I started talking to them about these kind of things. Like, have you thought about that? And then about closure. Most people want closure and they talk about the beginning of the mediation. This is making my blood pressure go up. My diabetic condition is out of whack. I have anxiety. I'm depressed. So I start talking about, what are some of the emotional things that you were really important to you? I start stressing these all over again. We kind of start over again. And then they start thinking about what closure means, because closure in COVID world means you're not going to trial for 3 years.
That's true. Yeah.
So really start thinking about that. And those are some of the BATNA things to talking about, because these are your alternatives. This is reality. And a little bit stronger at the end when we're really at that impasse. But those are things we talk about.
Yeah, we've planted the seed in our opening remarks. We planted the seed and we talk about what a mediation is and what it does and what the process is. And you also briefly talk about what the alternatives are then. It's a jury trial with no confidence in any resolution in your favor, with lots of expense, and we don't know when that trial is going to be held. So after 3 or 4 hours or a day or 2 days or whatever, you call them back to say, remember, I told you, and you know this, that we don't have a trial date, that you're not going to have a trial date in 2022, that it's going to cost you $20,000 or more to get this thing going. Let's take that into consideration and see if we can't reframe and reload this mediation and talk about some numbers from both your side and the other side and see if I can work on them. But the time is now. This is the last time you're going to talk to anyone who's interested in getting this case settled. The judge isn't, and the jury is going to tell you or the other side, one side very good news and one very bad news. Let's try to avoid that.
Mm-hmm. All right. And to Matt and to everyone, looking at the core values of mediation, what are those core values and how do you see the techniques today? How do they mesh with those values?
So we've touched on it, you know, earlier in the podcast, but, you know, mediation is a party-centric, party-driven process. It's their dispute. It's their decision whether they want to settle it or not. And as mediators, when we do these interventions, like proposing a range or pushing them towards brackets or even making a mediator's proposal at the end, we want to make sure that we're not overstepping our bounds, that we're still sitting in the position of facilitating the settlement and not driving it, because it is a party-driven process. So you get the party's buy-in, you know, hey, I'm thinking about now would be a good time to make a mediator's proposal. You explain to them what it is and you get them to agree to that process. So it keeps it as a party-centric and self-determination-based process. It also keeps the process fair. So fairness of process is another mediation core value. So if you get the parties to be educated on what you're doing and you get their consent, then the process is fair. And you want to make sure, as Doug talked about earlier, that if you're proposing like a mediator's proposal, that you let them know this is not what you think the case is worth. This is a number that you think is reasonably calculated to settle the case based on the way you've negotiated it today. And that way you maintain your neutrality and impartiality, which is, of course, another core value of mediation.
All right. Well, we are getting close to the end of our podcast. And there is a bit that I like to do at the end of all of my podcasts, and it's called Two for Me and One for You. So there's going to be two questions for you, the presenters, and one question that they will have for our listening audience as a kind of pop quiz to see if they were paying attention today. So to start, what is an interesting and relatively brief mediation story that you can share?
I was in a mediation of a very difficult case where a child was killed by a truck. So it was a death case, and the child was 23 years old. And the mother came to the mediation, and all over the table of the mediation was pictures of her son, you know, playing basketball, awards that he got, high school. It was a very, very tragic case. And it was a hard case. And the plaintiff's lawyer in the case was Jewish. And this is important to the story. So at the end of the day, we were settling the case, and the plaintiff asked the lawyer if he would pray with her. And he said, I can't pray. I'm Jewish. So I can't pray with you. So I said, well, I'll pray with you. And I thought about that. I thought about my neutrality at this point. But I had spent so much time with this woman and became very close with her and her lawyer. And I said, certainly, I'll pray with you. And we closed the door and we lit a candle and we prayed. And she said, I think I'm making the right decision. I didn't tell her she was making the right decision. But you connect with these people, and she needed someone to be with her at that moment. And so we prayed together and the case settled.
Oh, that's sweet. And that's so kind of you, too.
The case last week where I took the release to the plaintiff's house, the injured minor has very severe and damaging birth injuries. And my heart went out to the parents, who were very loving and had spent a lot of care. She was subsequently in an automobile accident where there was a lot of blood and a lot of airbags, but her injuries were not that significant. But it was more of aggravating of her day-to-day life. The injuries were so insignificant that the plaintiff's attorney said, I'm trying this on non-economic damages because the Robinson numbers or the lien numbers were so low, and plus they were paid by Medicaid. And my task, according to the plaintiff's attorney, who's a friend of mine, was to help him convince his client that the case should be settled. And so it was all about helping the plaintiff's attorney convince, get some trust with his client as well, because they were convinced that this case had destroyed their lives. When they started out, it was about a half an hour of crying and hand-wringing about how difficult it was to raise this child, which had nothing to do with the accident nor the injuries. At the end of the day, when we got it resolved and I took the release up to their home, I got a call from plaintiff's attorney and I talked to them. They said they were so thrilled that someone was finally listening to their story, and I was listening, and that someone had finally acted on all the pain they had gone through since this child was born. And it was another emphasis to me of the importance of listening and listening empathetically. You have to, they have to get your trust in a difficult situation. And it was not a long case as it turned out, but it was after about an hour of listening to the horrible things that they had to do to go through and raising this child. And she was a lovely child and she talked as well. It was a worthy case.
Sure. Yeah. Listening is huge, and having parties feel heard and understood is a big part of it. And being able to listen to them in confidence is important as well. I had a case recently where the case did not settle in mediation, but the parties agreed that we would do some follow-up in a month. And so we came back into mediation a month later, and they'd gotten pretty close before, but they had kind of stalled out. And the one side pulled me aside in caucus and said, I don't want to tell the other side this, but my life has changed and I need to settle this case now. And so I said, fine, you know, do you want to say anything more about that? And, you know, it was as simple as they'd taken a new job out of town and they were going to be leaving very soon and they didn't want to come back for the litigation, but they didn't want the other side to know that because they didn't want them to take advantage of it. And so the takeaway for me is that, you know, as a mediator, whatever you think the case is worth, whatever you think the merits are of the arguments, people settle cases for all kinds of reasons. And sometimes they have nothing to do with the case. And in this particular situation, the case ended up settling rather quickly, still in range, I think, still what I would consider to be a fair number, but maybe a little lower in the range because this one party had told me in confidence that they were leaving town and they didn't want to travel back to Ohio for the trial. So, you know, building that trust and rapport and being able to keep things in confidence and helping parties to put their dispute in perspective, knowing that this lawsuit is probably not their entire life, even though it might feel like it at times, but getting them to put it in perspective and think about a life after this litigation oftentimes helps get cases resolved.
All right. Thank you for those stories. And our next question is, who is an amazing person you know related to the field of mediation, and why do you appreciate them?
Say Peggy Jones, Matt Mattis, and Kathy Geyer. I mean, they're very bright. They're very experienced. They're easy to get along with, but they work very hard and they work very smartly. And they're absolutely dedicated to the core principles of mediation and getting it voluntarily done without influencing the parties. That they're very sharp. They're very good.
Yeah, I would agree with everything you guys said. I have two people on the national sphere that I think of often. The first is the person that trained me. His name is Gary Friedman, and he practices in the San Francisco Bay Area. His particular style is amazing to me because he uses a no caucus model where he mediates with all the parties in the same room together all the time, which is it's an amazing thing, and it is something to aspire to, I think, for me. And it also causes me to think twice about when I do separate into caucus, why am I doing that? Is there a benefit to keeping them together, or am I just separating out because that's what I usually do? So Gary Friedman is one person. The other is a mediator named Ken Cloak, whom I don't know personally, but I've heard speak a few times, and I've read a book of his called Mediating Dangerously. And he's another fearless mediator who is, you know, can ask the tough questions and really stick with the parties, even in the most difficult disputes. And so Ken Cloak would be another one for me.
I think that last year, when we had the dispute resolution, the conference that we had in Columbus, and Ken Feinberg spoke to us.
Right.
It was amazing that he came to speak live. And what was so cool about it is we had to cancel the conference the day of the conference because of COVID. And he stayed and spoke. There were about 30 of us there. I think you were there, Doug. But yeah. What an inspiration Ken Feinberg is. He handles these major master cases, the Boston Marathon, the settlement, the 9/11 settlement. But he always got down to the basic principles of what mediation is and what the role of the mediator is. And he always inspires me.
Ken Feinberger is brilliant. If anyone ever has a chance to listen to him, please do. You will learn a lot, and he's a very humble man.
How about you, Doug?
I'm not humble. You know that, Peggy.
No, I... Who's your inspiration? Besides Kathy Geyer, who's your...
Exactly. No, I followed Ken Feinberg for many, many years in many different forums. And in addition to doing like the 9/11 cases and the Boston Marathon, he does big commercial cases like the BP oil spill in the Gulf, and the 9/11 cases and the Boston Marathon case, there's no fee. He does those gratis. Okay. And he said, I get the big money from the corporations on the BP oil spill and so forth. But anyone who you know who's did any of the 9/11 cases on behalf of the victims will tell you he's nothing short of brilliant, admirable, and they can't wait to meet him again.
All right. I don't know who wants to field this one. I think we only need one of you to take this. But who would like to give the audience a knowledge check? What's a pop quiz question that they should be able to answer after listening to your podcast today?
Peggy's a teacher. Go ahead, Peggy.
I say Matt. Matt, you give the question. You're so soulful.
How funny. No, I was not going to go soulful here. I was just going to say, what does Malatna stand for? How about that?
Latna. Yeah, we got to do Zopa, Batna, Watna.
And the, Copacabana, right? And
Copacabana. Figure it out, listeners. Okay. Does anyone have any closing words today before we wrap it up?
I'd like to thank you, Kate, for doing this. This was really helpful. I'm sure for a lot of mediators that have not used these techniques. I know a lot of people love to listen to podcasts. They're doing them all the time now, and this is great. And I had a lot of fun seeing my colleagues again and working with them again. I missed doing the conference this year. So thanks for doing this.
My pleasure. All right. Well, that's a wrap for today. A huge thank you to the Honorable Peggy Foley Jones, Douglas Godshall, and Matt Menace for these really practical tips. I think mediators are going to be so grateful to have so many tools in their back pockets to use when it feels like parties are at an impasse and they're stuck. So thank you to all of you out there listening, and I hope you will join us for the next episode of the Civility and Solutions podcast. Until then, keep working for justice.